Welcome, everyone. We are so glad you are joining us today for a brand new deep dive.
Really excited for this one.
Yeah, me too. So I want you to picture something for a second. When you think about a classic superhero origin story, what instantly comes to mind?
Oh, usually it is this grand sweeping fantasy of aspiration, you know. It's practically a modern Greek myth.
Exactly. Like a relatively ordinary person is chosen by fate. They are granted these magnificent, physics-defying powers.
Right. They put on a brightly colored aerodynamic suit.
Yeah. And they stand heroically on the edge of a gleaming skyscraper, looking down at the glittering city they are sworn to protect.
It is the ultimate fantasy of empowerment. I mean, the entire aesthetic of that traditional hero is designed to be highly visible and, more importantly, triumphant.
Triumphant, yeah.
We are supposed to look up at them and think, oh, wow, I want to be that.
But then I want you to think about your actual life. Think about the modern corporate workplace.
Oh.
Right. If you dropped that brightly colored spandex hero into the middle of a Tuesday morning staff meeting, the whole concept suddenly seems entirely ridiculous.
Totally out of place.
Because the daily landscape most of us inhabit isn't defined by gleaming skyscrapers and triumphant poses. It is defined by gray cubicles, flickering fluorescent lighting, endless spreadsheets, and just sheer bone-deep exhaustion.
Which is exactly why the source material we are examining today is so incredibly compelling. We have excerpts from a fascinating conversation, well, a creative pitch, really titled The Inconspicuous Weaver, The Legend of Man-Spider.
Such a great title.
It really is. It features a woman named Marie Lynn pitching this entirely subverted superhero concept to her colleague, Quentin.
And our mission for you today is to explore how this seemingly absurd, wildly creative concept, which is literally a giant, horrifying spider wearing a business suit, manages to act as a brilliant, razor-sharp commentary on corporate culture, our collective societal blindness, and the exhausted tropes of modern heroism.
It hits all those notes perfectly.
It really does. Okay, let's unpack this. Mm-hmm. Because to really grasp the genius of Marie Lynn's pitch, we have to establish the sheer unvarnished physical reality of this character.
We do.
She calls him the Amazing Man Spider. Now, if your brain immediately defaults to a handsome, witty guy swinging gracefully from webs, I need you to stop. Erase that from your mind entirely.
Yeah, you really have to throw out the entire playbook here because the text makes it abundantly clear we are not talking about a human being with arachnid traits. We are talking about a literal spider.
A massive one.
A massive, terrifying arachnid that has somehow been awkwardly stuffed into a two-piece business suit.
It's such a wild visual. And when Marie Lynn drops this premise on Quentin, his reaction is just instantaneous reverence.
Oh, he loves it. He literally refers to her as Your Serene Highness and declares the idea instant canon.
And honestly, he's right to react that way. Mm. Because the core inversion here is so violently funny. I mean, to give you a mental picture of what we're dealing with, imagine the classic comic book trope.
Right.
Usually it's Peter Parker getting bitten by a radioactive spider to gain amazing agility and strength. It's the exact opposite.
Completely flipped.
It's like a giant apex predator spider was minding its own business in a dark basement, got bitten by a radioactive middle manager, and was suddenly cursed with a 9-to-5 job.
And a mortgage.
Yes. A mortgage and a really terrible, ill-fitting suit from a discount department store.
That image actually gets to the heart of why Quentin loves it so much. What's fascinating here is how the character's official tagline operates. Marie Lynn pitches the tagline as, he looks like a normal man, provided you never look directly at him.
Which is just brilliant.
It really is. That single sentence entirely subverts the psychology of the superhero genre. Think about the psychology of the cape and the spandex.
Right, the bright colors.
Exactly. Superheroes wear bright, contrasting colors precisely to be seen. They actively want to draw fire away from civilians. They want to be a highly visible symbol of hope and deterrence.
And Man-Spider.
Man-Spider operates on the exact opposite psychological principle. He needs people to actively avert their gaze. He relies entirely on the human instinct to avoid eye contact in uncomfortable situations.
You know, you would naturally assume that because he is a giant spider walking around in an office building, his camouflage must be some sort of high-tech perception filter or like a magical illusion.
Right, that's a hologram or something.
Yeah, like he projects a hologram of a normal guy named Gerald.
Yeah.
But the source text is explicit. His camouflage is terrible.
Non-existent, basically.
There is no magic. He is obviously, undeniably, a huge spider, which means his true superpower isn't webbing, and it isn't agility. It is what the text calls corporate invisibility.
Corporate invisibility, yes.
He is literally sitting through quarterly insurance meetings as an enormous hairy spider, and nobody pays enough attention to him to notice.
The source outlines exactly the mechanics of why this works, and it serves as a devastating critique of modern workplace psychology.
It really does.
The text notes that the people around him in these meetings are simply too underpaid, overmanaged, distracted, or socially trained to speak up. It is a masterclass in the bystander effect, but weaponized for the corporate era.
See, I'm sorry, but I have to call a timeout here and push back on the premise.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because calling this a superpower feels like a massive stretch to me. Is this actually a heroic ability, or is it just a tragic, depressing indictment of office culture?
Yeah.
Because to me, it doesn't sound like a superpower at all. It sounds like being stuck in a 3-hour mandatory budget meeting where everyone in the room is so desperate for the ordeal to end that they wouldn't point out if the conference room table suddenly burst into flames.
That's a fair point.
You just want to get through slide 42 of the PowerPoint.
Yeah.
You are absolutely not going to be the brave soul who raises their hand and says, excuse me, I don't mean to interrupt, but is Gerald a giant spider?
Right. You'd never do that.
Because the minute you do that, HR gets involved. There are incident reports to fill out. The meeting runs an hour late. It's just easier to look down at your notes.
I see your point, but I'd argue that you are underestimating how potent that environment is. Yes, it is a tragic indictment of the culture, but weaponizing that exact tragedy is precisely what makes it a superpower.
Okay, I'm listening.
Let's look at how the source text unpacks this. If we connect this to the bigger picture, that reluctance to speak up goes far beyond just wanting a meeting to end. It taps into the profound psychological weight of our social training.
Like how we're raised to behave.
Exactly. We are conditioned from a very young age, and this is hyper-enforced in corporate environments, not to make a fuss. We are actively trained to ignore glaring, sometimes terrifying absurdities right in front of our faces just to maintain the status quo.
Right. The golden rule of the office, don't rock the boat, just nod and pretend everything is normal.
Precisely. The text suggests that when human beings are chronically overmanaged, their autonomy is systematically stripped away. Eventually, you start to doubt your own perception of reality.
Wow, yeah.
If you see a giant spider in a gray suit taking notes on quarterly projections, your socially trained, burned-out brain doesn't scream monster. Instead, it tells you, well, upper management must have hired him.
I wasn't CC'd on the memo.
Exactly. It's not my department, and I'm not paid enough to deal with this. Best to just look at my spreadsheet. The camouflage works flawlessly because the environment demands conformity over truth.
I want you, the listener, to really think about that for a second. Think about your own office or your own daily routine. Have you ever sat in a room and ignored something completely bizarre or wildly inefficient just because pointing it out would cause a massive headache for you?
Oh, I'm sure everyone has.
That is the superpower. It is the ultimate Emperor's New Clothes situation. But instead of a naked king parading down the street, it's a terrifying, venomous apex predator drinking lukewarm break room coffee.
It's a great analogy.
But how does he actually use this depressing environment to fight crime? I mean, he can't just sit in meetings all day.
That leads directly to the brilliance of his specific cover identity. He doesn't just work in any random corporate department. Marilyn gives him a very deliberate role.
Right.
He is a regional manager at an insurance company.
So what does this all mean for his crime-fighting logistics? If you think about traditional superheroes, the logistics are actually terrible. Take Batman, for instance.
Oh, the logistics of Batman are a nightmare.
Exactly. Yeah. What is his daily operational strategy? He patrols. He drives around in a freezing, cold, dark city in a hyper-expensive, heavily armored tank, just hoping to stumble across a mugging in a random alleyway.
It's incredibly inefficient.
It really is. He has to go out and actively search for the worst things happening in the city.
It is terrible time management. But Manspider completely solves that logistical nightmare. By working in insurance claims, the crime and the disasters literally land right on his desk.
The paperwork just comes to him.
Exactly. He doesn't have to go looking for trouble. Trouble is mailed to him in neat little manila folders.
The source material lists the exact kinds of situations he encounters through this job, and it's just a buffet of misery. He deals with fires, floods, warehouse collapses.
Suspicious claims.
Yes, suspicious claims, industrial accidents, bad landlords, fraudsters, arsonists, and weird regional catastrophes. He has unlimited state-sanctioned access to every disaster in the tri-state area.
And it sets up this beautiful, jarring duality in his day-to-day existence. Think about how this plays out visually. He travels around to these disaster sites as the blandest possible man from claims assessment.
Just a totally forgettable guy.
Exactly. He is there to investigate mundane administrative paperwork. He is checking clipboards, looking at property damage, blending completely into the background of a tragedy. To the victims and the perpetrators, he is just another boring facet of the bureaucracy.
But then we get the transformation. And it is so visceral. He arrives on the scene, does the clipboard routine, and then he quietly slips away.
Right into the shadows.
Yeah, he ducks behind a ruined building or slinks behind a loading dock, and he violently sheds the suit.
The author is doing something very clever here. This is a direct, deliberate inversion of the classic Superman in a phone booth trope.
Oh, of course.
We all know that Image Superman rips open his mundane dress shirt to reveal the bright, colorful symbol of hope, stepping out into the light to save the day.
And Man-Spider?
Man-Spider goes into the shadows behind a loading dock, physically removes the suffocating constraints of his middle management attire, and steps out as what the text wonderfully describes as an eight-legged nightmare of public service.
An eight-legged nightmare of public service. It is such an incredibly upsetting image. You expect the hero to be this shining beacon, but instead it is just a massive hairy spider silently crawling up a wall to steal bad guys away.
Scaring absolutely everybody senseless in the process.
Yeah. It's funny, but it's also genuinely horrific.
It highlights the raw, almost monstrous utility of the character. I mean, he is investigating fraudsters and abusive landlords by day with a ballpoint pen and a carbon copy form.
Right.
And then he is physically removing those same threats from society by night with silken fangs.
Mm-hmm.
It is a hyper-efficient system of justice, but it lacks all the aesthetic grace we associate with heroism.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because the public relations aspect of this methodology is an absolute nightmare.
Oh, a total PR disaster.
I want you to imagine this scenario playing out in your own life. It is like having a superhero who miraculously saves your house from a violent burglar, but the way they accomplish it is by suddenly infesting your living room with a million terrifying, scurrying insects.
Right. It's horrifying.
I mean, yes, technically the burglar is gone. You are physically safe. Your television is secure. But you are going to need years of intense therapy to get over the trauma of the rescue. The cure feels almost as bad as the disease.
This raises an important question about how different strata of society process discomfort versus utility.
Mm-hmm.
And the source text spends a significant amount of time exploring this exact aftermath.
The fallout is huge. It is. It creates a profound moral tension. Marie Lynn points out that he does save people, but he does it in the most upsetting possible way. The text shows us the direct fallout, like children cry when he saves them.
Naturally.
Criminals don't just go to jail. They simply vanish into giant silk cocoons hanging from overpasses. And perhaps the funniest detail, Human Resources actually receives formal complaints about him.
Of course they do. You can just imagine the memos. Please be advised that Gerald from Regional left a massive, sticky cocoon in the visitor parking lot again. It is taking up two spaces.
Right, classic corporate problem.
But the source text draws a really sharp, fascinating line between how the media reacts to him and how the working class reacts to him.
Yes, the sociological observation here is quite deep. We see the establishment represented by the local newspapers running pearl-clutching editorials with massive headlines asking, "Do we need the spider?"
Right. The elites in the corporate structures, like the media and HR departments, fundamentally reject him.
They completely reject him.
But why do they reject him, though? I mean, if he's stopping arsonists, shouldn't the newspaper be thrilled?
Because the media and the establishment rely heavily on narrative and optics. They need their heroes to be photogenic, you know? They need them to give reassuring press conferences to fit into a neat, clean narrative of good conquering evil.
And Man-Spider does none of that.
Exactly. Man-Spider disrupts their comfort because he provides no narrative. He is grotesque. He doesn't reassure anyone. He just leaves behind a mess. But then contrast that with the reaction of the everyday practical people in the text.
The text specifically mentions farmers, janitors, librarians, and old ladies. The people who actually have to keep society running on a ground level.
Exactly. These groups look at the exact same situation and they actively defend him. They point out that spiders, biologically, have a voracious appetite for nuisances like bugs.
Right, they get it.
They write letters saying, actually, spiders are extremely useful. Leave him alone. They appreciate his raw utility because they understand that keeping a community clean isn't always pretty work.
They couldn't care less about the PR or the optics. If there is a bad landlord extorting tenants or an arsonist terrorizing their neighborhood, and a giant spider suddenly wraps that arsonist up in a cocoon and leaves him for the cops, the pragmatic people are just like, well, problem solved.
Yeah, thanks, Gerald.
Exactly.
Wait.
Thanks, Gerald. See you at the quarterly budget meeting. They are used to dealing with the ugly physical realities of life, so an ugly physical hero makes perfect sense to them.
It perfectly illustrates the class divide and how we view solutions to societal problems. The people who actually have to deal with the pests, both literal pests and societal pests like fraudsters, are the ones who appreciate the apex predator that hunts them.
They don't need the predator to be pretty.
Right. They just need it to be hungry.
Which perfectly sets up how Quentin summarizes the entire pitch at the end of the source text. He says that Tiny Quentin, which is just a great phrase referring to his inner child, already adores man-spiders.
It's a brilliant moment.
But the specific description he gives to Marie Lynn is incredible. He calls the character Batman for people who read pest control pamphlets and have unresolved feelings about middle management.
That single phrase perfectly synthesizes the entire subversion of the pitch. It completely strips away the billionaire glamour, the high-tech gadgets, and the gothic romance of Bruce Wayne.
All the flashy stuff.
Yeah, it replaces all of that with the grounded, exhausted reality of a modern worker who understands that sometimes the only way to actually clean up a systemic mess is to let a monster do its job in the shadows.
It is so good.
Yeah.
So let's bring this all back to you, because as wild, funny, and bizarre as the visual of a giant spider in a discount business suit is, Marie Lynn's pitch actually forces us to look in the mirror.
It really does.
I want you to ask yourself, how often do you put on your own metaphorical camouflage just to blend into the background of a chaotic workplace? Are you sitting there right now, nodding along in a meeting, staring at a spreadsheet, trying so hard not to be noticed while something totally absurd is happening right next to you?
Are you so focused on surviving the bureaucracy, so overmanaged and socially conditioned, that you are entirely missing the giant spider sitting right next to you?
It really makes you wonder how much we train ourselves not to see. And that brings us to the ultimate takeaway from this brilliant piece of creative fiction. We've talked a lot about the bystander effect and the need for comfort over truth.
I want to leave you with a final thought to ponder as you head back to your own daily routine. If societal politeness, corporate training, and everyday workplace burnout are truly so powerful that they can keep a room full of rational adults from pointing out a giant, terrifying spider sitting right there at the conference table,
which we know they can,
right? What other massive, glaring absurdities are we collectively agreeing to ignore every single day just to keep the fragile illusion of our routines functioning smoothly?